Thank you very much for coming to the station, and welcome to Western North Carolina.
My pleasure.
Bowing to the Emperor is a very personal story. It's the story of your family and your family's experiences as prisoners of war in Indonesia and Japan. How did it come to be that your family was in that part of the world?
We were in Hungary at the time when the war broke out in 1939. My father was in the reserves of the captain in the Dutch Royal Air Force. And he was called up, or basically, you know, had to go to Holland and report in and see where he was going to be charged to participate in the war. And at that time, he was an engineer, and he was very, very good at his job, and apparently was considered that by Dutch Shell. And Dutch Shell had quite a bit of influence, and they managed to get him to temporarily be dismissed, or not dismissed, but it was put off for a while he could go to Indonesia, to Sumatra in particular, and build an aviation fuel plant. And so we packed up, and in the 1939, at the end of 39, just in December, they packed up, got clothing that was for the tropics, and the three of us, three children, and my mother and my father, all sailed to Indonesia. And we were in Sumatra. Now, Indonesia at that time was not Indonesia. It was the Dutch East Indies. And that was, of course, a colony, or considered a colony of Holland. And that was the connection there. So my father went back, actually, to this place where I had been born just 2.5 years earlier, and the place where he himself was born 38 years before. We spent the next year in Sumatra building this oil refinery, and we were, of course, young, very young at that time. I don't have any recollection of that area at that time. And then the war came closer, and the Japanese started to make threatening noises. And then, of course, they invaded in Pearl Harbor, and the whole Singapore was being threatened. And so my father was finished pretty much with the aviation plant and then reported for duty, and they decided to keep him in Indonesia, not to go back to Holland in any way. Holland was having its own war over there, but this was our war over here.
You were in Asia before Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And then when Pearl Harbor happened, why didn't the family return to Eastern Europe?
He was in the Air Force at that time. And it was possible that they wanted to reassign him somewhere else, that Shell was interested in getting him in some other capacity somewhere else. But they, the powers that be in the military, decided that he was needed in Indonesia, and basically to look for where air bases could be set up in the various islands, especially in Sumatra, because Sumatra was the basis of all of the oil, and of course the Japanese were interested in getting that oil, because that's what war runs on. So my father flew all over in small planes, all over that area, in Borneo and in Celebes and in all of the other islands there, to see where bases could be set up. And they're talking about airfields. It's not tarmac. We're talking about just clearing the forest or the jungle in order to make it possible to just level it a little bit so that the airplanes could go there.
I want to talk a moment about your family, though. This is a very unusual family, an international family, if I dare say so. Your mother is born in Hungary. Your sister Yvonne is born in Germany. Your sister Maya is born in India. You have said you were born in Sumatra.
That's correct.
Your father was born in Indonesia.
Yes.
This is an international family, an unusual family.
It is indeed. And we had a home in Hungary, We were building a home in Hungary, and it wasn't even completed yet.
And your parents, just to add to this, actually met in London.
That's right. And they kept up a relationship for 6 years, while my father was actually in the States for 2 years after he got his engineering degree from Delft University. And then did rebuilding construction work in oil refinery in Italy and in Romania and in Germany and then in India. So each time that he had another place that he was assigned to, we went along, or those of us who were born went along. And Maya, for instance, is in India. That's where they happened to be when he was working there. And so that's how we got to be in all those different places.
So tell us how it came to be that your mother and her three daughters became prisoners in an internment camp in Asia during World War II.
Well, after my father did the all his work trying to build the airfields for the different airplanes in the Allied effort. By the way, he got a medal for that from the OBE medal from Britain as thank you for what he did to help with the RAF and to setting up the oil fields and also evacuating a lot of the military there. He then had to abandon everything because the invasion had happened. The Japanese had come down and invaded Sumatra. And so my father was one of the last ones to leave and escape to Java. And that's where we were then. We were in Java at the time. We had moved there already. And so all five of us were living there, my father, my mother, and the three of us. And he was based in Bandung and was at the military headquarters there. And then when the Japanese invaded Java as well, after having invaded Sumatra, he was taken off, as all the military men were taken prisoners. And then he had his own experience from then on. He went from one camp, several different camps in Java for a while, then to Singapore, and then finally he was taken off to Japan. We didn't know that. I mean, we didn't know where he was going or where he was taken.
And you didn't know if he was alive or dead.
We didn't know if he was alive or dead during that time. My mother did get two postcards, I believe, when we were in the camp. But they said something like, "Happy, you know, Merry Christmas." And what Christmas, what year, we didn't know. So that was, you know, it was his signature. So she knew at that time he was alive when he wrote it. But further than that, we didn't have any news of him. And nor did he of us.
You were a very young girl when you were in the internment camp. Do you have any vivid memories of what life was like there?
Not on a, I have flashes of memories. They're not an overall picture of the daily life. I couldn't tell you what we did every day. But a couple of things having to do with the war was having to do all with was hunger. One of the things that we had was that my mother gave us stories. She had shielded us so much from the horrors of war. So a lot of my memories are of stories being told. But she took the different tales, the different fairy tales, and they all made them all happy endings so that the Pied Piper didn't pipe all the children into the mountain and close the mountain, and that was the end of it. In her version, Pied Piper got paid, and he opened the mountain, and the children all came back with candies in their pockets. So this was her way of making life happy rather than sad, making the endings very positive. But one of the things I wanted to tell you about the stories also was that we were not allowed to talk about food because it was getting obsessive. Everybody was being obsessed with food all the time, and that was, she felt, was not good. So she forbade everybody, her friends and so on, from talking about food when they were together. But then she felt, well, maybe that we were being too repressed by that. So she brought a new rule in, or not a rule, but a new procedure, that we would have Saturday nights we could order food. And then it was this theoretical meal. And she said that after this theoretical meal, which each one of us would order in detail with four layered cakes and chocolate and being, but she said always that we ordered the same thing, and chicken and rice. I don't remember that. I remember ordering a piece of bread this thick, and butter that was twice as thick, and jam that was three times as thick, and that was so delicious. This is the type of memories I have.
Your mother Clara is credited with being the co-author of your book. She chronicled her experiences in the internment camp in an earlier book. So what prompted you to write this book and sort of envelop her story into your story?
We discovered a letter came from the Dutch Red Cross in Holland that they had found a suitcase that apparently belonged to my father from the war years. The tag on it said it had been sent by the Department of War, which was the name of the Department of Defense, of the Dutch Department of Defense, and that had been sent to Holland, to the Dutch Red Cross there in 1950. And it was contained these various documents. And the documents were handwritten by, we recognize my father's handwriting in that, and they were photographs. And then there were also a couple of photo albums that did not belong to us, that didn't, somebody else. So we assumed that. And then there was a towel, and there was a backpack, and there was a few other smaller things that sort of disparate things. We didn't really know whether they, were his or not. Some of them had his name on it, and the others didn't. And so these were all documents, but there were the photographs also. And the we assumed that some of the other albums belonged to probably some of the prisoners that had died, and he had been entrusted with them and was hoping to get them back to their family. Then the suitcase apparently disappeared. That's to say, it ended up in some closet at the Dutch Red Cross, and they didn't discover it until 2005. And they found that suitcase. And they contacted, the name Andro was there, so they looked it up in the telephone book to find out Andro's, and they contacted my second cousin, who was a genealogist by chance, and knew our address and so on, and he informed the Dutch Red Cross, and they sent a letter to my sister Yvonne and said, we found the suitcase. What do you want us to do with it, basically? I was just dumbfounded. And so my sister and I went to Holland, and we picked the suitcase up. And it was an old suitcase with sort of brass rivets on it, practically, and very, very primitive-looking suitcase. Certainly didn't have any rollers on it. And when I saw the documents in there, I thought, this is a good story. And then I thought, this is the other half of the story of our family. So I wanted to combine. Well, we knew the female side of the story pretty well from the books that my mother had written, and she had given us copies of it in the earlier book. And so what I thought to do was to combine the two stories. And since my mother was a linguist, she spoke five, six languages, but her English was sometimes a little bit foreign sounding, and a little bit, she would convert the words, put them at the wrong end of the sentence sometimes. And so her prose was not as smooth as it might have been. So I took the liberty of editing that, rearranging some of the material, but it's mostly her material. And that's the Clara part of the story.
So the missing suitcase, which had been missing for
55 years, probably, yeah.
Yeah, it prompted you to rediscover and to investigate the story.
Absolutely. And what I did is I found among my papers, among my you know, because I'm a bit pack rat. My mother had sent a diary, a typewritten, carbon copy of a story that the second in command to my father had kept, and it was in English. Because he has an English speaking wife, so he had made it sort of his diary, really, of these years. And my father, part in it was very prominent. So he would say, Andrew did this or Andrew did that. So I had a lot of the daily activities of what happened in that camp of my father. So that was my starting point, that and the documents I found in the suitcase. And then I went online and I found an American Marine who had been in the same camp as my father. And I thought I would interview him. So I flew down to here in the Carolinas to interview my sisters and pool our memories when I started this whole project. And I had emailed the Navy man who was the American Navy. He lived in California. And I suggested that I loop over to California and interview him. And he was 85 at the time, so I figured I'd better do it quickly. And he said, no, I can't do that because I'm going to be in North Carolina for a conference. And so it was just serendipitous.
Your father's notes were also in English, is that true?
Yes, that's true.
Why do you think they were in English?
Well, they weren't all in English. When he made speeches to his men, there were 400 Dutch men that he was in charge of. He was the captain and he was the senior officer and he was the prisoner head, you might say, of his men. And then a year later, the 200 Americans came, and they were part of this whole thing. So my father's was the overall head, so he tried to integrate the two different factions, the two different nationalities. Many of the Dutch spoke English or could understand English, but the Americans certainly couldn't speak Dutch. So a lot of his speechifying, you might say, was if it was to the his group, might have been in Dutch, but when it was to the whole group, it would have been in English. And also, we conjecture that a lot of his notes were really for the post-liberation, possibly the trials, the Tokyo trials.
Is this a survival story or a love story?
I see it as a survival story. I see it as a story of a family that was torn apart and basically also what war does to us. It's not, it doesn't affect men alone. It's not, because a lot of the diaries or a lot of the books that we read, Unbroken comes as an example, are about what men have experienced and the horrors of men's, and I'm not trying to downplay at all what men have gone through, but I wanted to point out also that women and children are affected. And we even now, this is 70 years since we were liberated, and there are still, my sister and I still have what we sort of refer to jokingly almost as prison camp consciousness, as far as not wasting food and being careful with things and, you know, wearing something out, waiting until it's completely whole with holes in it. Not actually, just aware of when we didn't have anything, when we were starving, and so this is very strong still.
How long were you separated from your father?
3.5 years.
And you were in the internment camp. How much of that time were you in the internment
About
camp?
About two and a quarter years.
So during that period, you really, again, you didn't know if he was alive or dead.
Either time, even if when we were under occupation, because we were under occupation for about a year and a half. My mother was left with no income, so she taught lessons, and she made jams, and she put in a big vegetable garden in order to feed ourselves on it.
You say it's a story of survival, but it's also clearly a story of a very strong family and a very loving family.
I see that, yes. My mother brought us through the war. If she hadn't done what she did, we probably wouldn't be here, because she was an extremely strong woman, a very, very strong ethical core. And she did what she felt was needed to protect us from the horrors of war and to keep our magic world of childhood alive. And she, I think she succeeded. I feel, but in a sense, in a very strange sense, we also made her survive. In other words, if we hadn't been there, she might have given up. At the one point, she started to get the hunger eczema, big patches on your skin, she was told that it would be another 4 months and she would be gone. And so she basically said, "You know what? How to survive that? Well, you can't. You know, but you have to try to do what you can." And she would do things like plant a few seeds that she managed to get from some sort of bartering way, and had some vegetables. And she went into the garbage, the little basket of sort of like a wheelbarrow on where the garbage was from the camp kitchens went, and she cut little tiny pieces of carrots stems or something or other in order to have some vegetables, in order to make some sort of nutrition, because all we had to eat really was just some rice and some very gummy bread, and there was no more fruit at the end and no more anything else.
She was only around 5 feet tall, correct?
A little bit, 5'1", baby.
But obviously a very strong woman.
Yes, very strong. And even at the end, she was at 90, she was still doing shoulder stands. At 92, she was visiting me up in Scituate in Massachusetts, where I live. And she went into the ocean, and she said, I had gone off swimming, and she was just in the early part of the near the beach part of it, and in the water. And afterwards, when I swam quite a distance and I came back, and she says, "You know, I don't know what's wrong with my body. It just doesn't want to do things anymore." I said, "Mom, you're 92. Oh, you know, so age was not a factor for her. She just had a very strong feeling about who she was as a person and what her role was.
Do you think she celebrated life differently than the way you celebrate life?
No, I think I channeled her quite a bit. I'm not as strong as she is, but I'm strong. And we have I have a feeling that she appreciates what I did to try to bring this book to a greater, attention of more people.
Do you have clear memories of when your family was reunited?
Yes.
What was that like, and where was that?
It was in Indonesia, in Java. We were liberated already, but we were still enclosed in the camp. Then they decided slowly to move us out of the camp to some of the vacant houses around it. And we were in one of those houses that they had no furniture. We had just dragged our mattresses there, but they had the space and we had the room, which up to that point we had been very, very tightly crowded and with families all living in one place. And my father came, and I didn't know who this person was, really. So I called him U, which was the formal, you, in which you don't do in the family normally. You normally did, the familiar, you. And so he was an U, and I was a little bit in awe of him, quite interested, but a little cautious. I didn't really know him at all, because I was four and a half when he left, and I was almost eight when he was, you know, at the end of the war. So a lot of the war, I'd done all the grown up without him.
Did he share his experiences freely with you when you became a little older?
No, not really. We continued traveling a lot. My father worked abroad a lot after the war. And so we didn't have the kind of close family life that you would think of as a family that, you know, works together and lives in the same place. So my father went in and lived in France or in Spain, and mostly France and Spain, I guess, and had his job there again, doing what he had been up to doing, building refineries in the north of France and in the south of France, both near Marseille and in Aix-en-Provence, and in the north in Etretat, which is near Le Havre, and that's where he was working. And my mother was the go-between. She would spend 6 months in one place and 6 months in another. But she was an excellent letter writer. So in a sense, we were connected all the time. And we would visit them in vacations. And they wanted us to have an education in one place, though. They didn't want us to have to follow him around again, you know, in our time. So we were really educated here, you know, and I went to Middlebury College and George Washington University and, you know, got my degree. And I studied in France for a year. And we went on vacations with them, you know, would spend the summer there. And so I never felt disconnected. But your question was whether he'd shared it. No, we just sort of went on. I mean, I don't think he was hiding anything or, you know, depressing anything. It was just that it was not interesting anymore. It was time to move on to other things.
What do you hope people take away from this story?
Of the devastating effects of war, that war affects not just the military fighters of it, but it affects everybody, and it affects children, it affects women, it affects families, and us all get them a feeling of what a refugee is. What is it like when you lose everything? How do you start over? And what is important? You know, the family that is important. It's important to have certain values that you stick with, and how you accommodate yourself with what those memories are and what ones do you want to discard and what do you want to remember from that experience.
Is it difficult for you to hear and read the stories of the refugees today?
Yes. I find it horror to see how, well, to start with, not right now, but a year ago, that the Mexican immigrants were being shouted at and called dirty and rejected, and these are people who are fleeing for their lives, because they're fleeing violence, they're fleeing horrible situations. They're not coming here because they want to be here, but this is a place where we have opportunities to work and to live and to start new lives. And so when you see that, and then you see the recent ones about what happened in Syria and the barbed wire that is rolled out in Hungary, and I was so ashamed for Hungarians, being half Hungarian myself, that they were shutting off these people who desperate.
So it's difficult.
It's difficult. It's difficult. And I don't know how to help that. But maybe this book will do something, will make people a little bit more aware of something like that.
Robin Andro is the author of Bowing to the Emperor, We Were Captives in World War II. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.